Well, hi everybody, and we continue with a treatise on white magic. We're on video commentary number 19, and we're on rule 2, and it's the third section. We're talking about hindrances. Concrete mind in itself offers opportunity for a treatise of great length, but here it will suffice to point out a few of the ways in which it hinders those races so paramountly represent it. We're speaking especially of the fifth root race, and I suppose the fifth sub-race of the fifth root race. So intense activity is one of the problems. The veiling effect of the disquisitions of the lower mind. And now we go on to the idea that discrimination may be a problem as well. So let's see. wait a second, let me get my little bracket here. By discrimination, another hindrance, and I suppose, you know, we're talking about the higher energies which may descend and which are invoked and hopefully evoked and which can be a part of the soul infusion process and even the triadal infusion process and eventually the monadic infusion process. By discrimination, a faculty of the concrete mental body. Now you do notice, and let's see, yeah, right here. Notice that discrimination in this chart provided by AUM is found on the fourth level, or the middle level of the mental plane. There it is very importantly placed to discriminate between that which is of the soul and the personality, but perhaps we're meaning a type of discrimination which might even be associated with the five of five. This is the fifth plane and this is the fifth subplane, and it is a very separative action, separating one thing from another, often necessarily so, but when it comes to bringing in the unity of consciousness, then no. Then it should not be so necessary and is an impediment. So it's a faculty of the concrete mental body. The lower bodies are trained in the art of distinguishing illusion from the center of reality, for the unreal from the real, the self from the not-self. This is the value of discrimination. Then ensues consequently a period that must be surmounted, wherein the attention of the ego is centered necessarily on the lower self and its vehicles, and wherein, therefore, the vibrations of the triad, the laws that deal with macrocosmic evolution, as would be found accessible in the triad, and the subjugation of fire for the use of the divine have temporarily to be in abeyance. Now, that temporary abeyance must really be temporary. It cannot be allowed to last forever. So we do need discrimination between this and that, between the soul and personality, between the lower self and its vehicles. However, it cannot go on forever because the ego or the soul in incarnation even are focused on those matters, and then the subjugation of the fire for the use of the divine, and when we talk about the divine, we mean the spiritual triad, and especially the Buddhic and Atmic planes, and we mean the monad. Spiritual is an adjective which is one step below divine. When man quickly sees the truth in all that he contacts and automatically chooses truth or the real, then he learns next the action, the lesson of joyful action, and the path of bliss opens up before him. That's very encouraging, especially on a down day, you know, which I'm sure we all have. When man quickly sees the truth in all that he contacts and automatically chooses truth or the real, then he learns the next lesson of joyful action. And the path of bliss opens up before him. Happiness, joy, and bliss. That's the sequence. How about two P's there? Happiness, joy, bliss. The sequence. The developmental sequence. When this is so, the path of occultism becomes possible to him, for the concrete mind has served its purpose. I mean, we're not trying to put it away the way so many students with mystical orientation seem to do. It's very necessary, but the period in which concentration is upon what it can do can go on for too long. For the concrete mind has served its purpose and has become his instrument and not his master, his interpreter and not his hinderer. You know, the old saying goes, the mind makes a good servant, but a poor master. So we're talking about who's in charge here. Is the mind in charge, or is the soul in incarnation in charge? So, the activity, the disquisitions, the discrimination, these are factors which all hinder the downflow of soul and triadal energy. And interestingly, it is one of the functions of the new esoteric schools not only to strengthen the etheric physical body and render the astral body more serene, less turbulent, but to bring the concrete mind into its right place so that it fails to act as a barrier between the student's consciousness, the disciple's consciousness, and higher states of realization. Now we go on to point D. Excuse me. The concrete mind hinders in another and more unusual way, and one that is not realized by the student who attempts at first to tread the thorny road of occult development. Obviously, let me go backwards. Yeah, that's it. The thorny road of occult development. When the concrete mind is rampant and dominates the entire personality, the aspirant cannot cooperate with these other lives and diverse evolutions until love supersedes concrete mind, even though he may in theory comprehend the laws that govern the evolution of the Loroic plan and the development of other solar entities besides his own hierarchy. And there are indeed, these other creative hierarchies, and he calls them solar entities. Interesting. And they continue to rise in their importance. Globe lords, chain lords, the planetary logoi are solar entities. But let's look at this again. You know, when the concrete mind is rampant, and we all know those who succumb to this condition. I'm remembering back some decades, and I'm sure I was one of them. When the concrete mind is rampant and dominates the entire personality, the aspirant cannot cooperate with these other lives and diverse evolutions until love supersedes the concrete mind. Well, after all, it is the next vehicle to be stimulated in our planetary development, because it is the ray of love is the sole ray of our planetary logos. Even though he may, in theory, comprehend the laws that govern the evolution of the logoic plan and the development of other solar entities besides his own hierarchy. Well, theoretical comprehension is good, but it is not all sufficient. And this is really interesting. Mind separates, love attracts. Mind creates a barrier betwixt a man and every suppliant deva, love breaks down every barrier and fuses diverse groups in union. Mind repels by a powerful, strong vibration, casting off all that is contacted as a wheel, casts off all that hinders its whirling periphery. Love gathers all to itself and carries all on with itself, welding the separated units into a unified, homogeneous whole. Mind repels through its own abundant heat, scorching and burning aught that approaches it. Love soothes and heals by the similarity of its heat to the heat of that which it contacts. We're talking about solar fire here, and blends its warmth and flame with the warmth and flame of other evolving entities. Finally, mind disrupts and destroys. It is connected with the destroyer aspect, the one and the three and the five being on the same line, whilst love produces coherence and heals. Well, let's see. Let's put that in a different color so that we can separate it. Well, let's take this to heart. Mind separates, love attracts. Mind creates a barrier betwixt a man and every suppliant deva who seeks to help. Love breaks down every barrier and fuses diverse groups in union. Mind repels by a powerful, strong vibration, casting off all that is contacted as a wheel casts off all that hinders its swirling periphery. Love gathers all to itself and carries all on with itself, welding separated units into a unified, homogeneous whole. We might look at the true church that way, or the true hierarchy, the society of organized and illumined minds. And yet, love predominates and wields those minds into a whole, and the minds are no longer the concrete minds either. They are triadal higher mind. Mind repels through its own abundant heat, scorching and burning aught that approaches it. Love soothes and heals by the similarity of its heat to the heat in that which it contacts. The union, the linking, is through solar fire, and blends its warmth, the warmth of solar fire, and flame with the warmth and flame of other evolving lives. Finally, mind disrupts and destroys, whilst love produces coherence and heals. Well, this is, and of course, I remember from days when I was reading these things that this was one of the outstanding sections, important, and maybe surprising in some ways, as obviously there is a strong emphasis in the Tibetans' work on cultivating a well-stocked concrete mind. Every change in human life is, if I can put this in my mind before I begin. This is page 80. We began on page 80, all right. Or page 80. All right, I'll try to remember that. Every change in human life is subject to immutable laws, if such a paradoxical statement may be permitted. Uranus is often the change, the restructuring, the bringing of a new condition into alignment with an archetype. In the attempt to find out those laws in order to conform to them, that's why we try to discover these laws, the occultist begins to offset karma and thus colors not the astral light. I suppose the originating of karma is the coloring of the astral light. And I want to kind of put that down as a possibility. Then can we say that the generating of karma is the coloring of the astral light. The only method whereby these laws can as yet be apprehended by the many who are interested is by close study of the vicissitudes of daily existence as spread over a long period of years. Indeed, we have to study ourselves and study others who are like ourselves, about whom we may know a little something. By the outstanding features of a cycle of 10 years, now DK emphasizes the importance of the 10-year cycle, not only the 7-year cycle. You know, wherever there's a seven, there's a three. And we see that in the Tree of Life, the Kabbalistic setup, where the three are above the seven. Maybe we see it in the globes and chains, where perhaps subjective three chains are above the seven normal ones, subjective three globes above the seven normal ones. So we have to study the vicissitudes of daily life spread over a long period of years. By the outstanding features of a cycle of 10 years, for instance, and probably maybe beginning from 0 to 10 and 10 to 20, 20 to 30 and so forth, as they are contrasted with the preceding or succeeding similar period, a student can approximate the trend of affairs and guide himself thereby. Think of where you are now and what you're involved in, and if memory serves, try to contrast the present cycle and its indications, if it's not too early into the cycle, with the previous cycle. When the point of evolution is reached where the student can contrast preceding lives and gain knowledge of the basic coloring of his previous life cycles, then rapid progress in adjusting the life to law is made, and that law is karmic law, the fourth law, in a way, the intermediate law of karma. Well, in the new schools, it is said that we will be learning how to recollect or remember or review past lives, and in an accurate manner, and one that is not filled with wishful thinking and glamour and all kinds of psychological complexes which distort the faculty of imagination in the attempt to retrieve these lives. When succeeding lives can be likewise apprehended by the student, as they are presently by the solar angel, we're told, who can see or does see several lives back, several lives forward, then karma, as known in the three worlds, as there are other kinds of karma, cease, and the adept stands master of all causes and effects as they condition and regulate his lower vehicles, that is, in the three lower worlds. A master is not yet a master of all things on the triadal levels, although he is there focused. So perhaps we all have some intuitions or some estimations of what our succeeding lives will be, directions in which we will be moving. And, you know, if we can stay away from clouding those issues with our hopes and fears, we're more likely to see. But then the one who can so do this, apparently, is standing at a high initiatory level. You know, third, fourth, or fifth degree, probably. Anyway, past lives and succeeding lives accurately seen or estimated. He aspires to the occult path and considers changes in events in the light of all preceding events, and the longer and more accurate his memory, the more he can dominate all possible situations. so interesting, these faculties that will be ours and which belong to the higher initiates now. We need accurate memory and not a memory which is distorted by unsound imagination fed by various complexes, unwholesome desires and fears and so forth. Thus, two of the hindrances will be found to be, and he's kind of summarizing here, because he's really dealt with it rather extensively, but here he summarizes. Thus, two of the hindrances will be found to be the comparative newness and change, which is characteristic of the Occident, the comparative newness of occultism to the Occident, and the rapidity of change, the general instability, we might say, instability, and the development of the concrete mind, which fits very much with the Occident, which is the Occident is the home of the fifth sub-race of the fifth root race. Okay, and so it looks like he's, shall we say, summarizing here, our third hindrance grows out of the preceding one. So let's look at this little recap that we're involved in here. Our third hindrance grows out of the preceding one. It consists of the emphasis that has been laid in the West upon the material side of things. In other words, that which the senses perceive. You know, materialism is, in a way, an excessive faith in the lower senses and the assumption that that which the lower senses reveal is the most real. And correspondingly, that which they fail to reveal is unreal. So this has resulted in a threefold condition of affairs. First, the world of spirit, or the formless world, abstract world of subjective consciousness, is not recognized in the scientific sense. You know, this is considered fanciful, and many very powerful minds who are excellent in other ways when dealing with the world of senses want nothing to do with what they think of as a fantasy world, which is formless and abstract. It is recognized innately, this formless abstract world, subjective world, by those of mystic temperament and by those who are able to study the subjective history of men and races. But science recognizes not this aspect of manifestation, nor do scientific men as a whole believe in the world of superphysical endeavor. Okay, so what are we having here? A threefold condition of affairs. Emphasis on the material side, and we're showing here, how this material emphasis has resulted in subsidiary problems. Okay, so here we see how the material emphasis has resulted in subsidiary problems. And the first one is that intelligent people, strongly influenced, I think, by the fifth ray, which connects with Mars in some respect, and with the five senses, just don't believe in these worlds. But progress, what do we have here? Yeah, they don't believe in the superphysical endeavor. All that in the earlier races held paramount place in the lives and thought of the peoples is now approached skeptically, and discussions are preceded by a question mark. But progress has been made, and much has arisen out of the war, and this is World War One. The question, for instance, is rapidly changing from the formula, is there life after death, to the inquiry of what nature is the future life, and this is a portent of much encouragement. So we're talking about these subsidiary problems, subsidiary conditions. Here we are, sorry. Subsidiary conditions arising out of materialism, which is subjugation to the lower senses. Okay, now another condition connected with materialism. The masses of people are suffering from suppression and from the effects of inhibition. Their, inner yearning for that which is real is discounted. Science has said there is no God and no spirit within man. Religion has said there must be a God, but where may he be found? The masses say we desire not a God constructed by the brain of theologians. When he says brains, that maybe, there are a lot of limitations that the brains place upon the mind. The brains place many limitations upon the mind. Therefore, the true inner comprehension finds no room for expansion, and the activity that should be finding its legitimate expression in the higher aspiration turns itself into the deification of things. That's very interesting. Because, I guess what the Tibetan is saying, this way, there must be deification. Deification. And if not related to the true deity, is then directed towards lower objectives. Things pertaining to flesh, connected with the emotions, or having a relation to the mind. Always for the human being, there must be some sort of higher being, higher possibility, and if that higher possibility is denied forcefully, then the yearning for that which is important and of value is directed towards lesser things, towards the flesh, the emotions, and the mind. And, all these things, all these areas are lesser than God, of course. The war, again, has accomplished much by relegating things to their just position, and by the removal of possessions, many have learnt the value of essentials and the necessity of eliminating that which is superfluous. So always the antidote, the problem of materialism is posed, but progress is also indicated. Progress in relation to all these conditions is indicated. Now, a third condition, of affairs growing out of the other two. A right apprehension of the future does not exist. When the life of the spirit is negated, when the manifesting life concentrates itself on things concrete and apparent, that's a big illusion, isn't it? Then the true goal of existence disappears. People don't know how to direct themselves forward. They lose hope. They lose courage. They cling to evanescences, things which disappear. The true goal of existence disappears. The true incentive to right living is lost. That perfection lies ahead and that we are in control of our own development. And the sarcastic words of the initiate Paul, quote, let us eat, drink, and drink, for tomorrow we die, characterize the attitude of the majority of men. I guess as a good Scorpio, St. Paul had lots of sarcasm. As a good Scorpio, St. Paul had the necessary sarcasm because his values were so utterly different, as he proved by his sacrificial life. So, you know, materialism is a big problem, just as the overextended discriminative mind and the activity of the lower mind and its many sinuosities, its disquisitions, its tendency to veil the truth through illusory reasoning. All of these are problems with the concrete mind, and yet we definitely need it and must, as students of occultism, not discount its value, because, you know, people do discount its value, and they then remain in the mystical stage. Men deaden the inner voice that bears witness to the life hereafter, and they drown the words that echo in the silence by the noise and whirl of business, pleasure, and excitement. And so what's going on here? A great evasion of the impact of truth. Well, we don't want to be fools, and we don't want to believe in that which is false. At the same time, there is this something in us that longs for continuance and development and expansion and deepening, and you know, we're not going to ever kill that out, and it will be perverted and distorted if it's not directed rightly. The whole secret of success in treading the occult path depends upon an attitude of mind, and when the attitude is one of concrete materialism or concentration upon form and a desire for the things of the present moment, little progress can be made in apprehending the higher esoteric truth. This, you know, has such sound wisdom in it, and here the Tibetan is in exact accordance, Buddha. So, you know, question your values. Let us question our values. Are we attracted to all the material possibilities? Do we wish to accumulate that which is evanescent, that we cannot take with us at the transition, whereas we can certainly take knowledge and love and, you know, states of consciousness with us? It seems foolish then to apply our faculties to that which cannot really help us grow. Now, a fourth hindrance. So, you know, in this recap of hindrances, let's see, non-recognition, suppression and inhibition, a right apprehension of the future does not exist. That's another one of these hindrances. And here we're not, you know, we're talking about hindrances to occult study. We're not necessarily, you know, and from the occult life, we're not talking about the hindrances which the concrete mind throw up, because we've already dealt with them. And this is a general, general hindrances. Let's see. Well, okay. The newness. Yeah, he's recapping. The newness is a hindrance. The development of the concrete mind in general, which we have examined, is a hindrance. So this is 1, and this is 2. And then the materialism is another hindrance, and we have divided this materialism into different kinds of conditions which result because of it. There's no recognition in the scientific sense. The masses are suppressed. A right apprehension of the future does not exist. And then he summarizes that we need a certain attitude of mind, and it can't be that in which concrete materialism, I suppose there is such a thing as really using matter, you know, spiritual materialism, but we can't have concrete materialism and the overvaluing of the form and the attachment to the evanescent conditions. We won't concentrate on the esoteric truth. But now, the fourth hindrance is found in the physical body, which has been built up by the aid of meat and fermented foods and drinks and nurtured in an environment in which fresh air and sunlight are not paramount factors. So it's not just the physical body, but it's the way it has been constructed. By the average individual. At one point he talks about the cruel meat-eating groups of the last 500 years. Something to think about, and yet the story goes that Alice Bailey, who had a blood condition, in order to sustain her activity and her ability to do the work, he put her on a meat diet. Or, you know, not exclusively, but, you know, including meat in the diet. I got that from Marion Walter, who was the youngest of the disciples and maybe the last living disciple out of the 50. And she knew Alice Bailey very well. He says, I am here generalizing and speaking for the masses of men and not for the would-be earnest occult student. For long centuries, food has been food that has been decomposing, and hence in a condition of fermentation, has been the basic food of the Occidental races. And the result can be seen in bodies unfitted for any strain, such as occultism imposes, and which form a barrier to the clear shining forth of the light within. Well, this is an occult perspective on how food affects us when there is pressure, strain, and how our light is dimmed and clogged by certain kinds of fermenting foods. When fresh fruit and vegetables, clear water, he gives the adjectives fresh and clear, nuts and grains, cooked and uncooked, form the sole diet of the evolving sons of men, then will be built bodies fitted to be vehicles for the highly evolved egos. And I don't know whether this is true or not, but I read it, and that the gladiators, who were certainly fighters requiring incredible stamina, lived on a vegetarian diet, and barley was extremely important to them. They patiently await the turning of the wheel and the coming in of a cycle which will permit of their fulfilling their destiny. So higher egos await the time of incoming. Now notice the word ego here is not meant as the solar angel. It is meant as a human being who probably has ability with the causal body and can focus within the causal body. The work of elimination and adjustment must be slow and tedious. Any true progress is going to be slow and tedious. Now, the overcoming of these hindrances, we have certainly, the body, the general condition of materialism, the concrete mind and its problems, and the newness of occultism in the West, these are factors which 90 years ago were important and probably still are. The overcoming of the hindrances, certain paramount realizations must precede this work of removing hindrances, and they might be enumerated as follows, certain paramount realizations. Okay. A realization that in obedience to the next duty and adherence to the highest known form of truth lies the path of further revelation. Obedience to the next duty, not necessarily the next desire, which one selfishly wants to fulfill. So that's, you know, certainly related to the physical plane and karma yoga and the performance of that which is indicated as necessary. A realization that dispassion is a great thing to cultivate, and that a willingness to undergo joyously any amount of temporary inconvenience, pain, or agony must be developed, having in view the future glory which will blot out the clouds of the passing hour. What great wisdom here. And, you know, I suppose this is a warning about irritation when frustrated. Dispassion is the great thing to cultivate, and that a willingness to undergo joyously, not just pass through grimly, to undergo joyously any amount of temporary inconvenience, pain, or agony must be developed, having in view the future glory. That's what we tell ourselves, that these moments are preparatory to the future glory. These clouds will dissipate. They will not last. This too shall pass, as wise King Solomon said, and, you know, it's probably a much older statement. A realization, number C, a realization that synthesis is the method whereby comprehension is attained, and that by blending the pairs of opposites, I suppose the horizontal pairs and also the soul personality, the middle path is gained that leads straight to the heart of the citadel of illumination, of the higher powers, of hierarchy, of Shambhala, even. Synthesis is the method whereby comprehension is attained, not just analysis, not just taking things apart, but seeing how all things fit together. With these three things paramountly controlling, so what do we have? Obedience, dispassion, and synthesis. Obedience, dispassion, and synthesis. These are things we must carry out. We learn and we carry out, if we don't forget. With these three things paramountly controlling his views on life, the student may hope by strenuous endeavor to overcome the four hindrances we've touched upon. What are these? You know, just it never hurts to keep newness, the concrete mind, materialism, the weak, the unprepared physical body. Okay, so in taking up our consideration of the second rule, we will deal first with the relation of the soul to the personality, primarily from the standpoint of meditation. There are so many ways that we can look at this interaction, which is not yet found, you know, in the lower kingdoms. We are dealing, therefore, with the greater light, and that is, you know, the light of the soul. and will take up later the throwing upward of the lower light. This is in line with the law of occult knowledge that one begins with universals. I suppose this is deduction in a way. Which is not to say that induction is useless. Sometimes we can reason from the part to the whole profitably, but generally the occult method is to begin with the greater truth and the higher perspective. It should be borne in mind that these rules are only for those whose personality is coordinated and whose minds are gradually being brought under control. Let's just say coordination precedes integration. The man, therefore, is utilizing the lower mind, the reasoning mind. That's one way to think of it, you know. This is not the intuitive mind, which apprehends straight knowledge. Whilst the soul is utilizing the higher or abstract mind, and the higher mind, you know, being found on the second and third levels, and abstract mind is a form of higher mind, but it is also the lowest point within the spiritual triad, so it's even higher than the other two sublevels of the second and third subplane. Both units are working with two aspects of the universal principle of mind. Okay, and on this ground, a relation becomes possible. So, reasoning mind is the lower mind. And let's see what these two aspects may be of this universal principle of mind. The man's work with his mind is to render it negative and receptive to the soul, you know, stilling the modifications of the versatile mental nature, the versatile psychic nature. The man's work with his mind is to render it negative and receptive to the soul, and this is his positive occupation. Note the use here of the word positive in the attempt to make the mind receptive, for herein lies the clue to right action, and we are not speaking of tamasic negativity or passivity. The soul's work in meditation is to make the point of that meditation so positive that the lower mind can be impressed, and so the lower man can be brought into line with the eternal plan, which the soul knows, at least some larger portion of it. Tamasic, you know what that means. It's the one of the gunas, an adjective describing a guna, tamas, rajas, and sattva, tamasic, rajasic, and sattvic, rhythmic. Okay, so on the plane of mind, we find what we normally call the soul, and even the abstract mind is there, even though it is not included within that vehicle we normally call the soul. Higher mind is. And within the concrete levels of concrete mind, the reasoning concrete mind, we discover that which must be positive to the soul and must be, in that sense, and impressed, receptive and impressed. So we do not in this way reason our way into the truth, but we open the concrete mind up to impression. Thus again, we have a relation established between a positive and a negative vibration. And the study of these relations carries much information to the student and is part of the teaching given in the preparation for the first initiation, wherein meditation becomes of importance, at least among those who are trained in a certain way. A list of these related situations might be given, showing them in their progressive relation on the path of evolution. So the negativity, it's a technical term, and it means that openness and receptivity to the mobilized higher mind, openness and receptivity of the lower mind to the mobilized meditating higher mind or soul. So the first initiation, we're not talking about the third, we are talking actually about the first, and we are learning to contact the higher power and bring it into expression, limited expression, but expression within the personality field, the monad also, but unknown to the personality, becomes active in relation, we are told, to the egoic lotus. All right, so here are some related situations. We'll see how much of this we can do before our hour is up. The relation between male and female physical bodies, called by man the sex relation and deemed of such paramount importance at this time. DK seems to say that this is fading or will fade, but not right away. Because we have the seventh ray coming in. The seventh ray is the ray connected with Uranus, which rules the sacral center. In the veil of illusion, the symbol oft engrosses attention, and that which it represents is forgotten, and we are certainly in this veil of illusion. The illusion of the lower 18 subplanes, conditioned by the separative lower mind and the distortions of the astral body, as well as the chaos of the etheric body. In the solving of this relationship will come racial initiation, and it is with this that the race is now engrossed, and so the return of the reappearance of the Christ, the first initiation, that's fourth initiation, okay, maybe this way, the first initiation and the solving of, let's say, certain aspects of the sex problem will all be more or less simultaneous. When the Christ reappears, it is the indication that humanity has taken the first initiation. And in order to take the first initiation, there has to be some regulation of the sacral center and its correlation with the throat center. Uranus has to be involved in elevating sacral energy to the throat center, which at a certain point is also ruled by the seventh ray and by Uranus. So we're talking about certain relations, related situations upon the path of evolution. Okay, the relation between the astral body and the physical, which for the majority is the control by the positive astral nature of the negative automatic. Well, I guess, you know, in this context, that which is positive is the controlling factor. The physical body, the instrument of desire, is swayed and controlled by desire. Desire for physical life and desire for the acquisition of the tangible. This is a Martian process. For Mars rules the dense physical body and also the astral body, filled with low is higher. And now the what we're striving for, a better type of connection for more advanced man, the relation of the mind and the brain, which constitutes the problem of the more advanced men and races, and of which the vast system of schools, colleges, and universities indicate the importance. This has to do with intelligent humanity. Much progress in this relation has been made during the past 50 years, and probably more since the 90 years since this has been written, and the work of the psychologist marks its highest point. When this is understood, the mind will be regarded as the positive factor, and the other two aspects of the form nature will respond receptively. They will be the automatons of the mind. So we see mind in a necessary controlling a position. And now the relation between the soul and the personality, which is the problem engrossing the attention of aspirants now, those who are aspiring towards their higher inner possibilities, for they are the pioneers of the human family, the pathfinders into the world of the soul. With this relation, the mystics and occultists concern themselves. And then, oh my goodness, this does go on. These relations go on. And so I think it is advisable not to go any further with this at the present moment. We've talked about four types of relations, moving backwards, soul and personality, mind and brain, astral body and physical body, and the sex relation on the outer plane, which is strictly in the veil of densest Maya, but is the symbol for something much higher. So we're talking about connecting positive and negative vibrations, and certain examples are being given. These examples are about the connecting of positive and negative centers, or points of focus, vehicles, etc. So let us say that this is the end of okay, this will be here the end of a treatise on white magic video commentary number 19 and rule 2.3. I hope so. I didn't want to have to go back to see this, but it becomes necessary. Yep, 2.3. And page 80 to 87. And we begin next time. See how I erase these things. Beginning of a treatise on white magic video commentary number 20. Rule 2.4, the fourth program, that is, from page 87 and onward. And there's not too much more to go in rule number two, and, you know, probably it will not be a program which is an hour in length, maybe not. What is interesting so far is that DK spends a lot of time discussing things that are not strictly in the magical process. Maybe it was in Cosmic Fire that he was doing more of that with some of the magical process. But maybe it will be coming up. The thought form that the magician is creating is like the lower light, and the creator is the higher light, just the way the soul is the greater light, and the three, the combined light, the lower light thrown upward, comes from the personality. Okay, friends, thank you very much for studying here, and let us study together all these things, and use this if you can or wish to in your study groups or for your own type of study. It never hurts and always helps, I think, to read slowly and carefully the works by the Tibetan's words. See you soon. Bye-bye.